paper 36, which is old single column, page 396. All right, so we did the main three, right? You know, the main three orders of local universe descending suns. Descending, as they're called, because they're, you know, bringing various aspects of the whole down into all of the workings of the local universe. Now we have another order of local universe suns, the life carriers, you know, life carrier suns, which are a little bit different in a number of ways. You know, the fact that they're fourth here in the sequence. Okay, so maybe in some sense you're thinking they're sort of, you know, the next rung down in some hierarchical series, and yeah, there's a measure of truth to that. But they're also, you know, above in other ways, as we'll see when we get into it. They're a very different flavor of sun, very fundamentally, because of their parentage, as we'll see when we get into them here. So let's just start with. Oh, I should maybe say right up front, especially the very beginning here. Yeah. Most of this paper, there's a lot of very dense content in this paper. So take a deep breath and settle in for a long haul, because there's a lot of stuff here that not only I might want to say up front, but you'll have lots of questions. And you know, so don't expect us to be reading tons in each session. There's a lot of very fun stuff packed in here. So let's start with that little preface there.
Paper 36, the life carriers. Life does not originate spontaneously. Life is constructed according to plans formulated by the unrevealed architects of being and appears on the inhabited planets either by direct importation or as a result of the operations of the life carriers of the local universes. These carriers of life are among the most interesting and versatile of the diverse family of universe suns. They are entrusted with designing and carrying creature life to the planetary spheres. And after planting this life on such new worlds, they remain there for long periods to foster its development.
Okay, now most of that, you know, is pretty straightforward then. But despite the fact that it's pretty straightforward, they've put, you know, all of those points up front because they want you to, you know, kind of always have that little preface in the back of your mind, fundamentally who you're dealing with here. You know, this, you know, and if that wasn't enough, they kind of embedded it right in the name, life carriers. You know, so they're obviously trying to really get you to hold on to that whole issue of about them being entrusted with designing and carrying creature life, and then fostering its development, etc. Now, that very first sentence, you know, anyone who's been involved with the Revelation for any length of time, you know, that's a pretty straightforward thing. But, you know, I hope everyone appreciates how not straightforward that is, that simple self-evident fact, you know, on the world we live in. You know, the most brilliant minds alive, basically, think otherwise. They think that somehow matter, you know, has within it certain magical properties that allow life and all of its, you know, complexity to just well up out of it spontaneously. Well, I mean, that's the old story that they tell the common folk, you know, quote unquote. But they don't even believe that because that's too causal. You know, the hardcore you know, have freed themselves of even that much causality of methane gas and lightning strikes and this sort of stuff. And, you know, and now it's literally pure magic, that mud stuck to a magic crystal and life began. That's the story. So, you know, there's just, there isn't anything of any substance at the core of all of the fancy hand waving that goes on in biology quarters, you know, today. You know, they'll put on a great show and stuff, but deep down, you know, they try to scurry people past the question of, well, how did life begin exactly? You know, and they try to get you all caught up in all the minutia of, you know, of what it did once it was there. Because they don't want you, they know that you're not going to go for the magic matter hypothesis. But that's the, what they believe. You know, now, on the other hand, you know, the word spontaneous, you know, when it's used in the Revelation in general, they want you to remember the literal meaning of that, of free will, spontaneous. So, you know, if you set all the foolishness of ignorant man aside, you know, and put yourself just more in the context, for them to say that, life does not originate just merely of free will. In other words, there is no magic man either, who just looks at the void and snaps his fingers and poof, out of nothing, there's something. Okay? It doesn't originate that way either. You know, and that's the most important thing that they would like you to appreciate. See, the very first sentence is, there's nothing finger snappy about life. It is a vast, complicated issue. It involves all kinds of laboratories and research and testing and whatnot, beyond anything we can even imagine in complexity. Okay? So, you know, it is a vast enterprise involving countless beings doing all sorts of tasks to bring this amazing phenomenon that is life into existence. Okay. So, no magic man and no magic matter. Now, this is the moment that you should have been long waiting for. okay, so
you're teasing us.
I'm teasing you, yes. You can flip back there if you want to kind of actually have some numbers and things in front of you. Back in section 9 of paper 31, you remember when we're going through that last paper of part 1, they have that section in there where they reveal some, you know, a lot of details that normally is not revealed at this anywhere near this sort of time in the evolution of a world about the architects of the master universe. Okay? Absonite beings, and quite a bit of detail about them. Okay, and let me just remind you of one of the basic patterns that we recognized as we were examining that, that little story they gave us. They, you know, they told us that there's 7 levels of the absonite in terms of just the you know, the direct nature of absonite actuality. It has 7 levels, and so there's 7 levels of master architects, tied to those 7 levels, directly, you know, at each of those 7 levels. And they start with the senior architect. There's 1 on that highest absonite level, the senior master architect. And they said that he is in charge of, oversees the coordination of, you know, in this highest transcendent absonite sense, and that's, you know, in that, you know, there's obviously stuff above the absonite, but you know what I mean. Yeah, relative to the finite, that highest absonite sense. He oversees the activities on paradise that are, you know, below his level of vision, and the first three circuits of the central universe, the circuit of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And then the next level of architects, it says there's three of them, and they oversee the seven circuits of Havona proper, the rest of the circuits of the central universe out from the central three. And then you go, wait a minute, I'm seeing a pattern there, aren't I? So I have one being tied to the singular isle overseeing three circuits. And then I have three beings tied to three circuits overseeing the next seven.
Next seven.
Okay, and so you're going, I'll bet you the next group there's seven. Sure enough, there are. Okay, so right there, recognize why that is not surprising, you know, in retrospect, and once you see that. Talking about the absonite, where you don't have the kind of separation between matter and spirit, or between power and personality, that we experience in the finite, you know, on the finite level. There's a very fundamental association, connection between thing and being. And so here you're seeing it, you know, you have one being, you know, that is in some way a parallel expression of one circuit. And if there's one circuit, there's one being. If there's three circuits, there's three beings. If there's seven circuits, there's seven beings. Okay. It's what the finite is heading towards in a power personality synthesis. You know, you're heading to match up with this which is, you know, pre-synthesized. In a sense, the absonite. Okay, so you know, okay, I've got the pattern. You know, and then you start to get some interesting bits of recognition. So, so the next one, sure enough, there's seven associated with the seven circuits of Havona, and they oversee the super universe level. Okay, and then you're going, well, how many circuits, quote unquote, is there in the super universe? What would the absonite being see? Okay. Well, the answer comes the next thing. There's 70 of the next group. Oh. So from an absonite perspective, you know, in other words, what will we experience in some way in an absonite geometry when we transcend this age? Some way there's going to be 70 fundamental circuits to the super universe level. It's like, oh, so I mean, and you already, you know, can see where things are going to go somehow. The super universe level, the whole super universe level, 70. See, so you have how you have 70 major sectors. See, you're going, so when this thing transcends in some way, each one of those major sectors somehow is a quote-unquote circuit in some fundamental element in the absonite geometry. You know, it may not be, you know, literally circuits like in the central universe. I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, what is absonite geometry? I don't know. But obviously in some way, see, those 70 elements that are there right now, which if you think about it, have a very distinct separateness already. I mean, obviously you have seven because you have seven super universes, but within a single super universe, you know, when you recognize those are pi wedges, those major sectors, that they're literally sectors in the mathematical sense of the word sector, a pi wedge, you know, there it's not like minor sectors where, you know, they're all over in one of those pi wedges and, you know, they're kind of balled together. You know, you've got this sector, which is separate from this one. So you can already see a pretty definitive separateness now. Yep.
So So I thought it went from one in the paradise, now two, paradise and seven worlds there, the three circuits of the Father, Son, Spirit, two
yeah.
in the Pavona, seven in the super universe, 70 in the first
episode.
Did I miss that?
No. So it goes one, there's one of the highest order, then there's three.
Who are in the Pavona, basically.
They're the three that oversee Havona. See, that's what you have to read carefully. They're three tied to the three circuits, okay, but they oversee the next block out, the seven circuits of Havona.
Right.
Okay. And then there's seven that are tied to those seven circuits of Havona, but they oversee the super universe level. See, this one, that's why I'm very carefully saying this. Because, see, there's an overlap. What they're by nature,
where they exist versus where they
exist. No. I mean, they're all on paradise. Okay. But what part, don't think, I'm trying to get you to recognize that matter and, things and beings aren't as separate as we think. That literally, the reason there are seven master architects that oversee the super universe level is because there's seven circuits in Havona, which is the chicken and which is the egg. No, very much not. See, it's orthogonal to that. It's the seven of the seven circuits. It's not seven around this way. It's seven radially. And see, that's very important to recognize. Okay? And the biggie, the thing that they definitely had to tell you, because you wouldn't have necessarily guessed it, is that the next number is 70. That you take 7 times 10. You get 70. Okay? Now, once you're out in the outer space levels, the pattern is relatively predictable, because they remind you that the master spirits don't just have supreme personality activity, they also have ultimate personality activity, and that the seven segments of the super universe level, there's seven segments of each of the outer space levels too. In other words, that other seven around, is in each level. There's a sevenfoldness that's getting applied. Because as you go to the outer space levels, you're going up 1, 2, 3, 4, up to higher and higher levels of ultimate personality activity. There's four levels of ultimate personality activity. That's why there's four outer space levels. And so each time you have that sort of over control of the seven master spirits, their sevenfoldness being imposed at a higher transcendent level, taking the previous level and multiplying it by seven, and then multiplying it by seven again, and seven again, and seven again. So, so when you get to that, you have 70 of the next group that are over, so in other words, their nature is tied to the 70 quote-unquote circuits of the super universe, but they're overseeing the primary outer space level. Okay, and there's 70 times 7 there. So you're taking this fundamental 70 of the super universe, you're taking it up one transcendent level to the first level of ultimate personality activity, multiplying it by sevenfold. Okay, and so now there's 490. There's going to be 490 quote-unquote circuits. See, in that level. Okay, so you go out. You have 490, and then you have 3,430. And then you have 24,010. Okay, and then finally, so you have 24,010 now that you recognize, okay, is how many quote-unquote circuits there are in the third outer space level in some transcendent absonite geometry when all is said and done. 24,010 circuits. So the last order of master architects, there's going to be 24,010 of them tied to those third level circuits, but they're going to oversee the fourth level. Okay, now we're done with the seven levels of the absonite and the master architects, but remember how we left that? It's like, whoa. See, when you very carefully step through it like this, you go, wait a minute. There are 168,070 then circuits in the completed fourth outer space level, 168,070. there must, you know, it's just sort of like it's just begging the recognition, wait a minute, there must be a group of beings that are, you know, literally by nature tied to that 168,070-foldness.
That are the beginning of the absence.
And you're going, well, who would those beings be? And you're thinking, okay, I've got a whole sequence of master architects. And then you go, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I know that if I can deduce it, they won't give me the name. But when they want to make you know sure I get it correct, they'll at least give me the name, but nothing else. Somewhere in the book, they'll give me the name. What would be an obvious name to put into this sequence so that there's 168,070 of them, the architects of being? It's got to be. I mean, I'm not going to say absolutely yet because I haven't, I haven't been able to put this to the full test yet. But that looks pretty darn suspicious. I'll bet you there is 168,070 architects of being. They're that next transcendent order. And then it's like, well, okay, is there anything, you know, how could I try to test this? It's like, well, what do the revelators say about transcending the master architects? They give you the little thought experiment that everyone has done since the dawn of time. You know, that if you try to make a 28,012th master architect, theoretically, it's seized by the absolute upholder, basically. It's seized on an absolute level. Okay, so think about this. Well, if these are the architects of being, the ones that the number of them is tied to the fundamental circuit foldness of the fourth outer space level, that next transcendent number, order of things, they're going to be transcendent of the absonite. They're going to be co-absolute beings in terms of their actuality of being, and they're going to be functioning on an absolute personality level. So I think you've got some of the cohorts of the consummator of universe destiny. See, who's the one very, you know, being that we, you know, are directly told is a co-absolute being, you know, functioning with absolute personality activity. The architects of being are most likely, see, some more of the co-absolute beings. And so that overseeing, you have all the master architects that are overseeing things, and then you have the ones that are overseeing beings. And that overseeing of beingness is a little more transcendent. It's in sync immediately with the co-absolute upholder. For those of you who have taken total deity or will take total deity, when you unpack things, you know, you figure out who the co-absolute upholder is. That's the mother aspect of the eternal mother son. Yeah, that's that, you know, trans master universe greater picture, the cosmos infinite. Okay. So now there's a lot there that is, you know, obviously definitely not just in that little preface paragraph we read. But that's the kind of thing where you're really sort of pushing the frontiers, you know, and it's like, good, you know, initial working hypothesis. Let's try to break the assumption that we've figured out basically where the architects of being fit into the picture. See if this works. There's probably other things subtly in the revelation, you know, that would put this to the test, and you can start looking for it. And that was, you know, not that long ago that I, you know, got to that point where, you know, I finally, you know, stepped myself through that. It's like, wait a minute, you know, and that's the way it always works. If you just very methodically start stepping through the deductive thing, you get to this point, well, and that implies, oh, I'm missing, I've got a being are beings that I've just sort of deduced, who are they? Oh, those are the mid-Sinaiters, or those are the unqualified, you know, et cetera. I mean, you invariably do this, you know, especially these ones where they've just given you a name somewhere.
And the parents of the architects are?
They're not allowed to give us all those details, you know, but in...
There's no parent.
Right, the whole bit with the absentite eventuated beings, you know. I mean, you can deduce what kind of deity fundamentally is personalized there, you know, when you work your way through unpacking total deity. But, you know, that doesn't tell you the parentage, you know. And, you know, it may be the case, like Andre's just pointing out, you know, when you think about what they say, you may want to actually begin to transition from the individuality viewpoint and parentage sort of understandings of things, take it to the unity viewpoint and think more directly, which you can deduce, like I said, you know, what kind of deity they are that's personalized. I mean, they are God. The architects of the master universe are personalized deity. They're God. So would the architects of being, you know, so is the consummator of universe destiny, etc. Those are various expressions of personalized deity. They're not just really, really high creatures. You know, they're personalized deity, they're God. I mean, the architects, you know, you very definitively know that. I mean, how? Is anyone, I mean, Andre, I'm sure, could, I mean, because they're...
Well, they're eventuated, for one thing. And, you know, as eventuated beings, they're not creatures.
But how do you know that they have a, you know, they can look God eye to eye. You know.
Well, they're members of the ultimate Trinity.
Right, exactly. They're part of the ultimate Trinity. See, so you're not surprised when you can finally like directly deduce. Okay, here's the kind of deity, and I know they're persons. They're super persons, of course. You know, technically, but they're personalized deity.
Yeah.
So the 128 do not include the 24. It's on top of the 24,000.
There's 168,070.
That does not include the 24,000 that came before. So the
right.
Total number is all those added up. So
well, I mean, you still just have the 28,011 architects of the master universe, mm-hmm. you know, that are absentite beings. But you've got these unrevealed architects of being, see, which are sort of in their series in a transcendent way, and that's why they gave them a parallel name, called them both architects. You know.
So you meant there's still 128,000 total, right? Is that
what you said? No. Okay. No. You have 28,011 master architects.
Which includes
the 24,010, 3,430, etc.
Okay.
Right.
And then you were just mentioning there's
168,070.
Architects of being.
Apparently the architects of being, you know, is what it looks like here.
That have something to do with the fourth outer space level, so to speak.
Well, I mean, their number is tied to the antecedent following, you know, the end from the beginning of the fourth outer space level. I mean, especially, see, when you get up to the absolute, you turn everything around very definitively, you know, and you definitely have to think top down, you know, and then you just, the fact that you have that top down, obviously, at the very top, you know, then you have to sort of combine in, oh yeah, and technically the supreme being, I can take it all the way down to the supreme level, technically the supreme being already exists from a top-down point of view.
So when they say life is constructed according to the plans of these guys,
right?
I was under the impression that in our local universe, our life is constructed according to the plans of our...
We're getting there. You're getting ahead. You're jumping ahead one step at a time. It all comes in due time in its appropriate paragraph. Right? But okay, just the one thing though that you were kind of hinting at there, think about how natural this identification is. If the architects of being that they're talking about here, that are the highest planners involved in life, so they are at the top of the whole planning of me coming into existence, or you coming into existence. Mm-hmm. Why would that have to be? Because when all is said and done. With all of the absentite ages, you have to be able to come into relationship, into co-absolute relationship with the infinite all are. Okay? If you're going to be able to do that, someone has to have planned for that from the beginning. Someone who's at the co-absolute level would have to have put in their input from the beginning so that you could have that potential to transcend. You know, one day you're going to say hello to the ultimate one, just like you're going to say hello to the supreme one, the supreme being. You're going to shake hands with the ultimate one and go beyond that. Okay? You're going to go beyond all of the, you know, near infinite complexity of the fourth outer space level. Okay? You have to, you know, everything has to be put in from the beginning. We're just about to read that, you know, with the life carriers. If I'm going to be a certain type of will creature, they have to build all of that into that initial single-celled eukaryotic plant, right? So that I have the precise number of chromosomes that I'm supposed to have and everything hundreds of millions of years later through all kinds of vicissitudes and whatnot, and mind connects to me just the way they want it to, etc. Okay, that all has to be planned from the beginning. You know, and so when the more you're thinking about down the road being planned from the beginning, the higher and higher being you've got to bring into play. Right? If someone is going to plan for me to be able to go into co-absoluteness, that has to be a co-absolute being, someone who's at that level and knows of that which he's ordering those below to do. Right? So, you know, there's, like I said, there's nothing that sort of immediately flies in the face of this being in a correct identification. It's highly suspicious that this is what's, you know, what those 168,070 beings are, is the architects of being.
An interesting implication in considering each creator son as being the personification of an absolute concept. Mm-hmm. Of the universal father and the eternal son in the context of their potentially being these
This very direct association, right, with these co-absolute beings. They are a consummator of universe destiny and all these things, and, you know, the co-absolute association and the absolute trinity and all these things, you know.
It really underscores the absolute nature.
All right, so just kind of fun, you know, very remote point to have, you know, overarching the whole picture. You can, you know, they put it right up front. See, that's what they're hoping. I'm pretty sure that this is what, you know, they were hoping that we would do this. That we would see the end from the beginning in the preface. That co-absoluteness is being built in at the, you know, from the ground level.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Right. See, again, how ridiculous they're trying to say it is that you would think that somehow you're insignificant, somehow you aren't being tended to, somehow no one cares, they haven't, I mean, we can't even remotely imagine, okay? Literally an infinite number of things have been planned into our beginning, right? Not a finite number of things, not an absolute number of things. I mean, it won't fit in absentite capacity. You know, when we say this distinction is vital, see, when you're saying that we exist in relation to the whole, okay, they mean that literally, okay? They want you to know absolutely from this point on, you know, that you are absolutely known and loved and planned for, and the entire universe is built so that you fit into it. An infinite number of things have been carefully, precisely designed so that you could fit into it. If they missed the tiniest little bit in one automaton, you wouldn't have a place. Not one thing has been missed. The infinite Father, you know, is on top of everything. You expand into that. Which issue has the Father missed? that you should ask him about. Do you believe in an infinite Father or not? Okay? An infinite Father has not missed anything. Trust in the Father. Okay? Don't pray in fear anymore. Let go of that. There's nothing that's been missed. So you can have absolute confidence in your Heavenly Father's overcare, right? Okay. Okay. So, life does not originate spontaneously. Right? If you've got co-absolute beings who are taking into account the every detail of the cosmos infinite from the beginning, okay, it's a pretty complex, detail-oriented process. No magic finger snaps.
And yet, mosquitoes are possible.
Yes. Infinity has its consequences, unfortunately. Yeah. All right. Okay, so there's a preface to behold. Yeah, so we start with the co-absolute. Let's come down to the ground a little bit more.
Section 1, Origin and Nature of Life Carriers. Though the life carriers belong to the family of divine sonship, they are a peculiar and distinct type of universe sons. Being the only group of intelligent life in a local universe, in whose creation the rulers of a super universe participate. The life carriers are the offspring of three pre-existent personalities, the Creator Son, the Universe Mother Spirit, and by designation, one of the three Ancients of Days presiding over the destinies of the super universe concerned. These Ancients of Days, who alone can decree the extinction of intelligent life, participate in the creation of the life carriers, who are entrusted with establishing physical life on the evolving worlds.
Okay, so yeah, that's what I was hinting to, if you didn't remember, up front. There are three quote-unquote parents for a life carrier, and one of those parents is an Ancient of Days. Super universe level, above the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit. So are the life carriers below the Melchizedeks or above the Melchizedeks? All right. Yes, they are both. All right. They're a very complex order of being. And the thing about having these three parents, that you can immediately begin to recognize the consequences of that. The more you've studied the book, you know, you go, now wait a minute. I remember something. If I flip to the beginning of The Over Control of Evolution, paper 65, that first section about life carrier functions, they tell me that life carriers are able to function and do function on the following three levels. One, the physical level of electrochemistry. Two, the usual mid-phase or quasi-morontial existence. And three, the advanced semi-spiritual level. Okay, now think about how immediate this recognition is. Okay, so three parents and three different modes of expression. You know, which one is going to be the dominant parent in a particular mode of expression? You know, we've already set this up. We know that the whole dominant recessive phenomenon is fundamental in understanding the genetics of all these beings. Just because they're spirit beings doesn't mean they don't have genetics. Okay, and then that basic dominant recessive thing is in play all the way up to the highest levels. Okay. Now, when we're talking about Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek, we saw how we had, you know, the two parents and one was dominant and the other was recessive, and then vice versa. You know, we had the Creator Son being dominant for the bright morning star. We had the Creative Mother Spirit being the dominant for Father Melchizedek. So one was more he-like, and one was more she-like, as it were. You know, and that recognition allowed us to, you know, immediately understand a whole bunch of things about the Melchizedeks, why they had the natures that they did.
But what we had to bring up was that because she's a creator being, she can choose which side is going to be dominant.
Right, of course, right.
And we can't, and I just wanted to make that
right.
distinction.
Right, right, you definitely are. They're creator beings, and so they have control of their knobs. You know, we just sort of are a conduit for life. We don't have a lot of control over the knobs of the process. Okay, yeah.
Can I just say something? Maybe you're going to get to it. But so if the pre-existent person, now the offspring of the creator's son, so he's the one that creates life, the universe mother spirit who gives the spirit in the
earth. No, in this case, all three are just as much creators. You don't want to separate that.
Okay,
no.
I was just thinking that each one, then you could see why the ancients of days who could judge and extinct will make these beings that are going to be almost exemplary where they won't, you know.
Right, there's certainly that, right. But what we want to recognize is even on a deeper level. You know, when we really think about, we want to go beyond how these beings act as personalities. We want to really think about the nature of what's being personalized. What kind of an actuality, what kind of a self do they have? What selves fed into making that self that then got personalized? Okay, but what's the nature of their self? They have a threefold self nature because they have three parents. Okay, now the normal, you know, see the usual mid-phase or quasi-morontial existence. Okay, so normally these life carriers are in this mid-phase, and when you start unpacking all the details, you know, we'll get to this later in paper 36. You discover that there's two types of life animation, two phases of life animation that get bestowed through a life carrier. One is the reproductive spark, and one is just the foundational living vitality. Okay. And they bestow that living vitality in their normal mid-phase mode. Okay. When you figure out what the source of life animation is, the mechanics of its bestowal, and all those details, and you unpack all of that, okay, you figure out the fundamental role of mother, deity in this process, and also spirit-type deity. For just the living vitality, just that foundational phase of the life animation, okay, it's not the reproductive spark, it's not what powers eukaryotic reproduction. Okay, plants and animals, you know, multicellular plants and animals, the reproduction. What underlies that, what powers, you know, the more basal elements, and the only thing that powers, say, prokaryotes, in terms of their animation powers, quote unquote, not literally power, you know, but is behind the animation of. Okay, the reproductive spark involves both the mother and the spirit, but the living vitality is just the mother. So if you're going to be for them to be able to bestow just living vitality, not reproductive spark, they have to have a conduit within them, that their nature has to be such that it can be just mother without spirit. Well, that can't come from the creative mother spirit. She has both spirit type deity and mother deity together. That's the reproductive spark conduit, the fact that she was one of the parents. The ancients of days are what kind of origin beings? Trinity origin beings, and the mother deity stems from the Trinity. Okay, that's one of the reasons why they need to have an ancient of days for a parent. So they, part of their nature that can be, and it's their normal dominant mode, the other two are recessive. You know, the creator, son, creator, mother, spirit elements are recessive. The dominant one, their normal mid-phase, is this natural conduit. So just in their presence, if they build any sort of living structure, potentially living structure, automatically that life animation, without them doing anything, just, you know, becomes associated with it. Okay, but, you know, we'll get to the point where they point out when they do that, there's no reproduction, no reproductive spark. They have to be modified to bestow that. Okay, so the usual mid-phase, that's where our Ancient of Days is the dominant expression. Think about, you know, okay, when they're going to bestow that reproductive spark, when they've built the first eukaryotic cells and they need to bestow reproductive spark on them, those, you know, initial plant cells that they're going to, you know, deposit in the shallow seas, okay, they get modified, you know, before that so they can build it. So they literally can manipulate matter. They're at the physical level of electrochemistry, so they literally have interactive ability with matter. You know, like I can grab this and move it around, okay? They can directly interact with matter. Before she was the creative mother spirit, she was just the creative spirit. And what was she doing? She was working with the power beings. She was really part of the controllers rather than the cosmic mothers, you know, in the chart. She, you know, from the infinite spirit, the non-personal, you know, that has the ability to come directly engaged to matter. See, so when they're in the phase, you know, in phase one, the physical level of electrochemistry, that's when the creative mother spirit nature is the dominant of the three modes. So they just, you know, when they're modified, it's like, you know, it's like they have three faces and they're just rotated, you know, to make what was a recessive face the dominant face. And so they're manifesting the creative mother spirit, being able to engage matter directly, interact with matter directly, and bestow the reproductive spark, which requires a spirit and mother together as one conduit to do. Again, you have to just, you know, that's a detailed, complicated thing to unpack and get to that point of recognizing that. But those two go hand in hand. Oh, so the advanced semi-spiritual level, when they're done with, you know, and they've got will creatures on a world, if they want to hang around, they have to be modified into the advanced semi-spiritual level. Okay, so that's when the creator sun face is rotated out and is dominant. And now they're really a son of the creator sun. Now they're really the fourth one down in the tier in descending suns. Okay, so it's in that mode. See, now they've been sort of... Before that, they've had a lot of transcendence, but when they've done their job, if they're ready to make that transition, they're brought down very much into the local universe hierarchy as that next lower tier of suns in terms of the, you know, the basic nature of them as a spirit sun. They aren't as radiant as a Lunanandek. Right, the ones that are here are in that semi-spiritual level, and they're really very much see suns now. They're just functioning as part of the descending order of sonship, and they do things like other descending suns, see, when they're at in that mode, you know, helping guide the world. Okay.
When the periods come down to the fourth mode of functioning, do they stay there, or do they still have the prerogative to?
When they're modified so that they can, you know, initiate life with the reproductive spark, they're just temporarily modified while they do that, and then they're brought back to the mid phase.
Okay,
and they're in the mid phase mode all the time when they're overseeing the evolution until will creatures, and then they either have to leave, you know, or they have to take their vows and get modified.
They
beings come in and modify them, grab a hold of them and rotate them, quote unquote, say, you know, alter their nature.
Who are those beings?
Unrevealed, basically. But, you know, power beings are involved. You know, they give you a couple of clues, but by and large, we don't know.
So when they talk about the Ancients of Days here, they have this little descriptive participle after it. So the ones who can, you know, why do they use that? The only ones who can distinguish life. In that particular instance, because so many nice things they could say.
Okay.
You know what I'm asking?
Yes, I know what you're asking. And the answer is, we need to remember what the preface was. They were trying to remind us that this whole life thing is very much a top-down oversight phenomenon. You know, why do you have capital J judges, the Ancients of Days? Why are they the only beings that can extinguish? Okay, because they're the only ones that are high enough, you know, to see that subtlety of specificity in play. You know, they're a backdoor way reminding you that the life carrier has a measure of the higher objectivity of an Ancient of Days. That's why so much can be put into their hands. The Ancients of Days could intervene in things, and Michael could intervene in things. But by and large, as you see when we're reading, it's handed over to them, and they go off to it. It's like, wow, that's a lot of responsibility to put in the hands of a being that's below London Index, isn't it? No. When they're in that mode, they're really at eye level with the Ancients of Days. They see things to the depth of minuteness that's required for you to be in charge of extinguishing beings, for instance. Okay? Nothing is missed. They know this, all of the subtleties. They can, by nature, they are in relationship with that, those subtle details, and can be given such high charge. So here's another example of, you know, we were noticing this. It's like, wait a minute. So we thought we had this simple linear hierarchy. We had Melchizedek, Verondadex, Lenonadex, life carriers. Okay, but we noticed that every other one here, there's an asterisk. In one sense, a Verondadex was below a Melchizedek. In the other sense, they're up at the level of the Ancients of Days. Then you skip, you know, then you definitely have a notch down. And then you have the life carriers and, oh yeah, in the semi-spiritual sense, they're, yeah, asterisk. In the other sense, they're up at the eye level of the Ancients of Days. Do you remember with the seven bestowals of Michael? You know, he was kind of working his way down, wasn't he? He did a Melchizedek. Did he do a Verondadek? Did he do a Lenonadek? Did he do a life carrier? No. He skipped those two. See, because that's really, he's going down. You know, he's going to skip over those ones that are above him, kind of, in ways. He goes from Lenonadec to material son, and then to angel, seraphim. You remember. See? Ones with the asterisk, those ones that are really, in a sense, higher than him in some ways, are being skipped over.
Well, without digressing too much, are you saying that no creator son?
I don't know what I'm saying, but I just noticed all we have is the one example.
But it'd be interesting to know, and it will be, to study that, in the next life, what creator sons.
Right. I mean, I don't, you know.
Decided to do, because they can choose any other. They're creatures, and
right?
You
have a very curious thing here. Yeah, that's the question. See, that's the immediate question that is being begged there. Huh? Do you suppose that they always have to be skipped, or maybe if the local universe is radically different than ours, maybe not. There's all these unrevealed things. You know, there's no way we can remotely answer that question. There's too many things that are unknown. But in terms of what we've revealed, it's an obvious pattern which one is being skipped here in these of the four. So,
mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. Let's see. What else do we have in there? Let's see. We had the. Yes, right. We were in the midst of. Yeah. So did I answer that enough about the Ancients of Days and why they brought in the extinction life? Is that, they're just trying to remind you that, there's a higher integrity there.
There's something that came to mind for me. Two things. Well, first one was Bill Cosby.
I brought you into the world and
take
you out.
Yes, right. Yeah.
I wasn't going to mention that one, but the one I did think about was when they're standing there extincting, and the Ancients of Days are extinguishing someone, and the life carrier saying, "Where did we go wrong?" I mean, this is a big responsibility.
Yeah, but of course they didn't. You know, see, of course, yeah, it didn't go wrong. But see, you can see. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, that you wouldn't the kind of integrity that a being has to have for him to be entrusted with extinction of intelligent life.
Yeah.
Okay, that same kind of integrity is entrusted with the establishment of physical life on the evolving worlds. So this whole question of did someone goof? No. As we'll read, did a number of things manifest on this decimal world that, they didn't calculate in advance? Yes. But was there any mistake? No, not one, not even in a 50th decimal place, okay? I mean, it's exactly as it's supposed to be. The thing, the wild card is, is not error, quote unquote, or anything like that. The wild card's the supreme. And we'll get to that in a little bit. If you want to blame someone for the mosquito, blame the supreme being. You got to hold that thought for a long time. They're not a personality anymore. See, so right. I mean, remember, it's just you have energy systems that aren't subject to the second law of thermodynamics. So someone's got to turn them off, and they're in charge of turning them off. Yeah. Okay. See, like I said, took us half hour for each paragraph. Okay.
In the universe of Nebadon, we have on record the creation of 100 million life carriers. This efficient core of life disseminators is not a truly self-governing group. They are directed by the life-determining trio, consisting of Gabriel, the Father Melchizedek, and Nambia, the original and firstborn life carrier of Nebadon. But in all phases of their divisional administration, they are self-governing.
Okay, so that last statement, you see, is, except for the little caveat that there's this kind of bigger structure going on, all phases of their divisional administration, they are self-governing. So it's a very rock-solid statement. See, so, it's not like they're literally not as integrous as Lenonidex, they're below them. See, no, not at all. I mean, they're definitively self-governing. Okay, so they have a high degree of integrity. Okay, right. Yeah, you have to wait. You have to be patient. We're coming around. Okay, so yeah. So the obvious big thing there is this once proper noun here of Nambia. Okay, now, I tried to set this one up a while back, too. If you recall, in the... No, it doesn't have anything to do with the Lion King. boy, I tell you, the peanut gallery is active tonight. I don't know. okay, so... do you remember when we were introduced to the Father Melchizedek back at the beginning of paper 35? And I pointed out that they had the little following comment in passing about the contrast between Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek, where they said, Gabriel is occupied more with universe policies, Father Melchizedek, with practical procedures. And you recall, I got you to reflect a little bit on the contrast between policies and procedures, between thought and its expression, word. Okay? If you're reflecting on that and you're going, wow, that's a lot like the contrast between the thought God and the word God, the policy and the procedure, the policy's expression as a procedure, do you suppose there's a third element? Is there a full Trinity, personalities of the Trinity pattern here? Yes, there is. We just found the third. Okay? And I printed it out, because nambia is one of the etymologies that I have figured out. And so I printed out the little thing from the etymology here to have in front of me. It's pretty fun when you figure this one out. Okay, so we're talking about life carriers. And the whole point of life carriers and planting life here, get an evolution going, and they're trying to evolve what? Will creatures, humans, right? And those first two will creatures on this world are named Ann and Infanta. And where were they? You know, where was home there for the beginning of the human race? Northwest of India, right? Yeah, basic northwestern region. You know, heading in the Pakistan, you know, Afghanistan direction, you know, today. Okay, from India. Okay, so if you know, if you head to the north west of India, like I said, you know, you move into what? The Indus Valley. Okay, remember they're coining English words for when they have to coin a word, they're you know, it's supposed to be as if it evolved, you know, from ancient tongues into an English word. That's the, you know, what they're told to do. Everything has to be done in English. So, I mean, English has its roots in Indo-European, you know, and most of the time, it's the European part of Indo-European, right, that you're drawing from, you know, northern white race roots or Latin or Greek. But it is Indo-European, the Indus Valley. What about that part of Indo-European? What about Sanskrit? Yeah. NAMB is the Sanskrit, that stem is the Sanskrit verb to go. So literally, nambia is the one who goes. Okay? So think about that, okay? As I said here, the name refers to his place in the Trinity pattern of the life-determining trio. Gabriel, thought; Father Melchizedek, word; and nambia, action. Okay? It is the life carriers who actually go to the barren planets and initiate and subsequently foster creature life. They're the ones that go. They're like the god of action. That's what they were doing with those. You know? And that was a simple example. You know, I searched far and wide, and you can find all kinds of NAMBs. You know, it's like, well, I don't know, could it be that? And, you know, but when you finally stumble on that and find it's the verb to go, it's like, ta-da! Right? Because it's a life-determining trio. It's obviously, you know, it has to be action. Yeah. It's not word action. Right. And, you know, and for them to actually play it like that, you know, and take the Sanskrit side of Indo-European because of where Ann and Infanta, that's where they, that was the homeland right there in future Sanskrit land, you know. Right? Yeah, so it's a pretty fun little thing they did there. Someone was being very creative when they did that one. Okay, so that's the fun thing there. So these first three paragraphs, you have these kind of major side lights like this. You know, and it's a simple example of, you know, they're using the AI suffix, which is already there in English, you know, for the person, you know, when they want to indicate a person, you know, and they've coined the TIA suffix for the impersonal suffix. You know, so when it needs to be, you know, just the thing or the place or whatever, like Urantia, you know, when it needs to be, you know, a place rather than a person. Yeah. So there, you know, there's an example of using the, you know, the pre-existent IA suffix in that mode. All right. Okay, I think that's it. Let's get some more.
Life carriers are graded into three grand divisions. The first division is the senior life carriers, the second, assistants, and the third, custodians. The primary division is subdivided into 12 groups of specialists in the various forms of life manifestation. The segregation of these three divisions was effected by the Melchizedeks, who conducted tests for such purposes on the life carrier's headquarters sphere. The Melchizedeks have ever since been closely associated with the life carriers and always accompany them when they go forth to establish life on a new planet.
Okay. Now, okay, so just like with the Lunanindex, you know, we are in this lower order that does need to go through the schools on Melchizedek and get some sorting into bins, sorting into categories here, okay? So that, you know, fits with them being fourth in a, you know, in the series. The biggie that's first, you know, mentioned here and is going to be popping up constantly, the number 12, okay? I'm not going to unpack that for you because that involves a lot of very complex details of unpacking the central universe, okay? But you've got, you know, these fundamental numbers of 3 and 7 and 10, and now here's 12. You know, sometimes we forget about 12 is another one of the very important ones. And all those fundamental pattern numbers are coming from the pattern universe. And once you sort out all the details going on there, you discover there's a 12-fold pattern in the central universe that is behind this basic mode of life expression. And we'll see a little bit more specificity when we get into the first section here. Just wanted you to know that you... You know, at some point I'll have an advanced class. We'll go through the central universe, and we can get to the point of unpacking that. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you got to do before you can get to that detail. But it does naturally come out. You finally, you know, I had no idea when I was started unpacking the central universe. You know, it was just, you know, way into it, and I'm going along and, it's the 12, you know, I've been, you know, wondering for ages, you know, where in the heck this 12 comes from, and it finally falls out naturally. So you can, you know, have a better understanding of the source behind this 12-foldness. What's, you know, what's going on there, what's being expressed. Okay, so there's that. We'll see, like I said. Now the other kind of zinger thrown in there is... Okay, it's one thing for them to go through the tests on Melchizedek, okay, but then the Melchizedeks have ever since been closely associated, you know, and always accompany them, you know, like, so for instance, like even on the scouting party, you know, when it arrived back, you know, way before life implantation, you know, the life carriers were here long before, you know, the first plants, they were here, and Melchizedeks were in that party. You know, tells you that. But why? Why is there this joined at the hip thing going on here between the Melchizedeks and the life carriers? Why are they so intimately associated? Okay, the clue was unpacking that previous paragraph. Once you recognize that you've got the three personalities of the Paradise Trinity pattern going on here of thought, word, action. Okay, so, you know, at the Paradise level, we have the Universe Father, the Eternal Son, and the Infinite Spirit. And subsequent to the experience in Havona, we don't just have the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit, we have the Eternal Mother Son and the Infinite Mother Spirit. Those two beings have something very directly in common. Mother, right? We figured out back when we did the Melchizedeks that the, you know, Father Melchizedek, and hence all the Melchizedeks, are a mother dominant. They're like Eve's son as opposed to Adam's son, right? See, so it's, and when we just, you know, recognize we got the Ancients of Days, a direct Trinity expression, so that there's mother, you know, separated from spirit, just a pure mother conduit. See, it's the mother-to-mother commonality that's joining together here. The second, you know, the second and third in the Trinity pattern, you know, are together. Like, think about, you know, you get way up to Jesus' papers, and you have word coming down of whether or not Jesus has completed things. And the eternal mother's son and the infinite mother's spirit together say yes. The mother voice says yes. The father voice says no. Right? You know, so you got to remember, you know, that it's that mother, you know, that makes them, you know, that takes the three and makes a duality, you know, out of it to a degree.
That happens in my family.
So the second and third are together as one to a degree. Right? Right? See, so keep that in mind. Always be kind of be looking for that to pop up in various places where you don't see them functioning so much as three independent existential facts. But you see existential and experiential. You see a duality, you know, voice coming out of the three made two. See? Okay? So here you're seeing it again. You're seeing the fact that there's that linkage between Nambi and the Father Melchizedek. So there's a linkage to all the Melchizedeks, you know, below Father Melchizedek and all of the life carriers below Nambi. Yeah? You know, there's an association that is in play right from the beginning and follows through. And see, and again, it's the mother thing that's the key. all right. Let's see. Anything else there? I think that's it.
When an evolutionary planet is finally settled in light and life, the life carriers are organized into the higher deliberative bodies of advisory capacity to assist in the further administration and development of the world and its glorified beings. In the later and settled stages of an evolving universe, these life carriers are entrusted with many new duties.
Okay, so a couple things there. The first part, life carriers are organized into the higher deliberative bodies of advisory capacity to assist in the further administration and development of the world and its glorified beings. I mean, if you go up and read, you know, as the world goes into the first stage of light and life, second stage of light and life, etc., you know, you see them referring to this, you know, where you really have these life carriers now in that sun, more sun-like mode, see, of a semi-spiritual being, like I was saying before. Joining in the process. And what's the main thing that they're overseeing? Okay, it hasn't changed the fact they're still life carriers and they were involved in life from the beginning. You know, when you're getting in those first stages of light and life, now it gets very serious. You are going to eliminate, you know, even the slightest hint of lesser quality from the race. Okay, this is when it gets very, very definitive, you know, and they're not just going to tweak things and slowly over time and attrition and whatnot. And now they're going, you know, it says they very definitively get right in there and they purge every last vestige of any, you know, limited aspect to our genetic character. Okay, you know. And so remember what's going on. I mean, you know, they're purging a people that are so transcendent of us right now that we can't even imagine it. Okay, so I mean, no one in this room, you know, is even allowed on a world like that. You know, let alone would I, you know, miss the cut. Okay, you know, you're not even in the picture. Okay, like we were talking about before, I mean, we can't even our genetics right now is so limited. We can't even imagine a post-bestowal world, you know, in a normal phase, let alone, you know, having the kind of mind being able to seed on us so that we could conceive of light and life. Okay, it's just so beyond our imagination. Okay, but they still, you know, they're talking like like it's horrendous. It's like we've got to purge these horrendous elements, you know, and the stuff that they're purging is so transcendent of anything we can imagine in quality.
Do we not have to have those potentials that we're passing along?
Of course, right. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, but it's just a matter of the whole time element. See, it's once the world gets to light and life, see, what they're saying indirectly there is that there's more Father-like intervention allowed, and you won't be in rebellion. Before that, obviously, the Supreme holds most of the cards, basically, see, in the process. And the Father-like intervention, they can do little things, but you know, mostly they have to let it play out over time, let the process, you know. But there comes a point, they're telling you there, when you can, the Father-like hand, the sons, see, can intervene very directly and just get it over with in relatively short order, and then you're done. Yeah.
Not to say they line everybody up.
No, I mean they just don't. They don't allow them to procreate. I mean, just as always,
right?
You know, they just, you know, the whole and go back and look. What kind of being are they trying to create? They tell you they're trying to create the most definitive philosophic being. And they use the word philosophy to describe, the, you know, a being who is a perfectly formed personal living philosophy and is in perfect synchrony with the cosmos. That's what they're trying to form. Okay. See, so, you know, you're long past any issues of, wow, you're kind of biased to the individuality side, or you're kind of biased to the, you know, the spiritual side or whatnot. I mean, we're at a point now where, you know, we're just totally working on the vertical things, and you're not quite cosmic enough. You know, so you're going to disappear through attrition. You know, you're not allowed to procreate. You know, or you know, you can have, you know, one kid or something. You know, and, I mean, but in very short order, all of the lesser cosmic philosophic quality disappears, and you just have the cream of the philosophic crop left. You know, the most super additive consequence that can come out of an initiation of science, relationship to science and religion in an evolving people. It's finally being brought to the full philosophic super additive consequence in light and life. Okay. Yeah. So just, you know, go up there and look. I think it's in the second stage of light and life that they talk about that, and notice them bringing up philosophy. And then the other thing here, see, in the later and settled stages of the evolving universe, okay, so when the local universe is settled in light and life, we've talked about this a number of times. That means, you know, it's basically brought into the Trinity government of the super universe, and it's really the Ancients of Days, or, you know, and the Supreme Executives are overseeing what's going on in a local universe. Michael is probably not even there much anymore. He's on Paradise, and you know, the Veranda Dex that are very intimate with the Ancients of Days are taking a definitive role. Oh, and look who else is. The other ones that are very intimate with the Ancients of Days, they're entrusted with many new duties, see, because they're, you know, they're back functioning at that eye level with the Ancients of Days, their other parent again, see, once you get to the local universe settled in light and life. So that process, though, I mean, see, they've grown. You know, as that lower sort of sun, through a long process, they sort of reacquire that definitive relationship to the Ancients of Days above, and then begin to express it again. So they're going to be very, very grand beings, you know, and, you know, when all is said and done with the finite. All right. So that first little chunk in this life care repair is pretty fun. Okay, and now they start to jump into some details, as those who are familiar. So let's see what time. Yeah, we've got some time to get into some details here.
Two, the life carrier worlds. The Melchizedeks have the general oversight of the fourth group of seven primary spheres in the Salvington circuit. These worlds of the life carriers are designated as follows. 1, the life carrier headquarters. 2, the life planning sphere. 3, the life conservation sphere. 4, the sphere of life evolution. 5, the sphere of life associated with mind. 6, the sphere of mind and spirit in living beings. 7, the sphere of unrevealed life.
And that last one, just, you know, we'll see it when we finally get to that, number 7. But so you have it up front. We're talking about, see, in sequence there, we're not, you know, so much talking about those other beings, sort of horizontally unrevealed life. Not like, it's, you know, see, we're talking about mind life, mind spirit life, and then something above that. Okay, that's the sequence here in there. We'll see that when we get to the end. Okay, here it is again. Okay, so they're called the life carrier worlds, the 4th group of 7. Okay, maybe I should, you know, if you've forgotten, remember what we're doing. We're group by group, we're going around that one string of pearls around Salvington. They're broken into 10 blocks, you know, 10 segments, where you take 7 primary worlds and their sub-satellites, and 7 more, and then 7 more. Okay, so we're in the 4th group of 7 as we're going around Salvington. Okay, and each of them has 6 sub-satellites around it. And they're the quote-unquote life carrier worlds, but there's that intimacy with the Melchizedeks. The Melchizedeks have the general oversight. I mean, that's telling you, this is really a close association. And the fact that the Melchizedeks, you know, relative to local universe immediate affairs are above, see, they get, you know, they're the ones that have the general oversight. And then the life carriers would have the specific oversight. But the hierarchy is coming out there, and this intimacy of the, through mother commonality, is right there. Oh, I guess, yeah, you ought to read that. I should have let you just read that last thing there, too.
Yeah. Each of these primary spheres is surrounded by 6 satellites, on which the special phases of all the life carrier activities in the universe are centered.
Actually, so yeah, in the wake of what I just said there, see, the very fact that they specify the special phases, you know, see, the more specific. So that may be, you know, maybe it's the case that the life carriers have, you know, a lot more of a quote-unquote general-like oversight over the sub-satellites, maybe, just because of their higher specificity. That's a possibility, you know, might be between the lines there. But in some way, you've got the two of them kind of working together on this. All right. Anything else we need to say there? Okay, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, it might be too simple for you, but...
I'd love to have a simple question. I just had to explain the architects of being.
But it's interesting that each one of these spheres, these 7, where they are designated, they really live. They have to, like, the life. So they have, some of them have, they have to have a life planning sphere. Then they have to have a conservation sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to have, make a life evolution sphere.
Right.
Then they got to make a mind sphere. Right. You know, and then the spirit and the mind. So I think that was really cool. But that's where they have to have the headquarters at.
As you have all broken up like this again. Remember the very first sentence. Is there like a magic finger snap going on here? No. I mean, this is like, you know, insanely complicated. You know, every little detail has a whole group of 7 worlds devoted to it. Great, big, huge worlds with countless beings, you know, involved in all the minutia. It's a very, very complex process. You know, there has to be lots and lots of hyper-specialization involved. You know?
It even gives the 7th one, the unrevealed life.
Yeah, or even higher, right, yeah, and see, just all these details that have to be taken care of, you know, so again, it helps you to appreciate why one of the things they said up front is, if you, in order to make this happen, you have to have a lot of very hyper-specialized people. Well, the more hyper-specialization you have, the more important that you have people who are, you know, staying back and keeping the big picture, you know, in play. So you have to have, you know, very, very high big picture, the architects of being, you know, there's going to be a whole hierarchy of big picture individuals, you know, with countless specialists working under the umbrellas. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, remember, this is part of Melchizedek University. Every one of these worlds, all 490 of them, right? So, yeah, you're going to go through every one of these, you know, and getting part of your education, you know, on each one of them, yeah.
In fact, we're going to be Marantia re-keyed.
Yeah, right.
After each task on each one of these worlds, even the satellites.
Yeah, yeah, good point. I mean, it's so new and significantly different, you know, that you are literally having to be modified in order to be able to accept, you know, what you're going to be taught. You know, you don't have the capacity until you're, you know, broadened out, you know. Get the crowbar in there and pry you out a little bit, and, you know, then you can fit this new stuff in.
On the rack.
Going to tell us someplace where, how that spark of life is given,
yeah,
to a sperm and an egg?
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, yeah. I mean, we'll get into a lot of that, you know, as we go through this paper. Now, of course, some of the details are, you know, are up when we're dealing with evolution in part three, but yeah, a lot of those, you know, those basic sort of the nature questions are addressed here as, you know, as opposed to more of the implementation questions. Those are done in context with evolution. But yeah, we'll go through all those, the life activity, the living activity, and the reproductive spark. You'll see where they tell you that there's two phases of that and all that sort of stuff, yeah.
I think that's a question that a lot of people puzzle over.
Yeah, and it, I mean, as you probably tell, in order to understand all of the details, you got to bring in a whole bunch of deity and unpacking things to understand exactly how, you know, because this all has to be brought down from the reservoir for life animation, which is the facet of deity called the infinite, which is up at the infinite level. Yeah, you got to get that down through the co-infinite, the absolute, the co-absolute, the ultimate, the absonite, the supreme, down to the finite. You know, you have this whole complicated hierarchy. You've got to bring that down. And yeah, and like I was saying, some involves just mother, some involves mother and spirit. But you can unpack all of those details, you know, by once you have deity in play, so that you know, have the language to talk about it. Okay. Yeah, we've got a half an hour. This is we'll probably spend the whole half an hour on world number one. My guess is there'll probably be lots of questions here. Okay.
World number one, the headquarters sphere, together with its six tributary satellites, is devoted to the study of universal life, life in all of its known phases of manifestation. Here is located the College of Life Planning, wherein function teachers and advisors from Uversa and Havona, even from Paradise. And I am permitted to reveal that the seven central emplacements of the Agenant Mind Spirits are situated on this world of the Life Carriers.
Okay, so that last part, that's a, you know, we'll pick up that detail a little later in the paper about the Agenant Mind Spirit emplacements. There's certainly some details that are not going to be immediately apparent. You know, the fact that they can say, I am permitted to reveal, okay, you know, it must be right up against the edge, and there's probably things I can't even imagine yet that you'll figure out because of that. But we were just talking about this. See, so, you know, notice that's the very first thing that they address. What we were just thinking about with the specialists and the generalists that are going to be needed, keeping the big picture. So you go, the first thing it says is, wait a minute, devoted to the study of universal life, you know, et cetera, and located the College of Life Planning. Like, wait, I thought the second group was the life planning sphere. why is the College of Life Planning on the first sphere? Okay. Okay, the details are going on in the second. But the big picture is being, you know, taken care of here. Okay? All right. So this is, so here they're going to be in charge of making sure that, you know, of all the details fit into the cosmos. And the specialists are going to work on details and see, these are the interface people. And you'll see that as we go forward, how that works. But that's so life planning specificity, life planning generality. Okay?
It sort of intimates that this is not just life in our universe that you're going to be studying. Especially if you have these guys from outside the universe working.
Right. I mean, yeah.
Like, you could be looking and studying life, all life.
Right. Yeah. Like, what did I say when I was just describing that? These guys are going to make sure that the life that's going to happen in this local universe fits into the cosmos. Okay, not the local universe, not the super universe, the whole picture. Okay, and how is this rooted? Where are all the patterns for all this life coming from? The pattern universe. You know, all of this is coming out of the central universe. Okay, in terms of a source patterns, so you have to have beings coming from Havona and Paradise. Okay, they're in charge of making sure that everything is that's going to go on when they hand it off to the detail guys. You know that it's all appropriately, you know, attuned to Havona and the source patterns, attuned to all the expressions in the whole universe of universes. Yeah, all the big picture stuff.
My point was more when we go there to learn all this stuff.
You're going
to
learn, yeah.
You know, and then eventually when we get to the central universe and experience it rather than just learning it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to learn a lot.
Yeah, you are, yeah. Yeah, and so the fact that you're going to learn this much about the details makes that statement. They tell you that when you actually get to Havona and you meet someone from another super universe, it will still be completely unanticipated what you'll experience. Okay, just it makes that statement all the more powerful to recognize that, you know, you can know theory until you're blue in the face, but until you experience it, okay, we're experiential creatures. We can't acquire the truth of it existentially. You can only acquire it experientially. So they will still be radically, once you get your composure and start analyzing what you're experiencing, go, oh, that's, you know, I learned about that. I see how that links back to the, you know, foundational elements, and, you know, you'll be able to put the pieces together then. But, you know, but the super additivity of what, you know, you may know all about the details of the biologic foundation and how mind, is attuned to that and all this. But the super additivity, especially in a full personality sense, see, is not predictable in advance. You know, when you see what a personality does to that transcendent mind seated on that genetics that you knew all the formulas about, you know, you'll be struggling to get it connected. Like, wow, that comes from that. You know, and it'll take you forever to kind of appreciate just how that can be, okay? But that's, yeah. Really great you brought that up. That's a good way to further that. You know, when they say, you think you've seen strange, no, you have no idea. Wait till you meet someone from another super universe. Yeah.
Wait till he meets you.
Yes, yeah, it works both ways. Okay, let's see. Make sure we don't forget anything in there. Let's see, what else? Okay, I think I got everything there, yeah.
The number 10, the decimal system, is inherent in the physical universe, but not in the spiritual. The domain of life is characterized by 3, 7, and 12, or by multiples and combinations of these basic numbers. There are 3 primal and essential different life plans after the orders of the 3 paradise sources and centers. And in the universe of Nebadon, these three basic forms of life are segregated on three different types of planets. There were originally 12 distinct and divine concepts of transmissible life. This number 12, with its subdivisions and multiples, runs through all basic life patterns of all seven superuniverses. There are also seven architectural types of life design, fundamental arrangements of the reproducing configurations of living matter. The Irvatan life patterns are configured as 12 inheritance carriers. The differing orders of will creatures are configured as 12, 24, 48, 96, 192, 384, and 768. On Urantia, there are 48 units of pattern control, trait determiners, in the sex cells of human reproduction.
Okay, gigantic paragraph with lots of details. Let's start at the beginning and slowly step through it. Okay, so they start out, they say, okay, definitely you have 10 all over, that the tenfoldness of the tenfold individuality. Okay, and then they bring in, we also have 3, 7, and 12. So there's that 12 again, and then of course there's going to be all sorts of super additive consequences of relationships between all those patterns, but like they mentioned there, and by multiples and combinations of these basic numbers, but you know, try to just figure out the basics first here. Okay, now, as you go through that, did you pick up, so you have 3, 7, and 12, did you notice that the way those manifest is 12 on the top, 7, and then 3. Okay? That the 12, you know, was something, there was a 12-foldness that's super universe independent. There's a 12-foldness that wraps all the way around. You know, so that, you know, you can forget about the 7-foldness. You know, when you're thinking fundamentally about the 12-foldness, that it's sort of at the, you know, at not at the individual super universe level, but at the collective super universe level, that there's a 12-foldness. Just like we've talked about, you know, how there's mothers at local universe level, individual super universe level, and collective super universe level. There's a collective super universe level that has the 12-foldness. And then they say you drop down, okay, and then you have a sevenfoldness, you know, because of the seven super universes. So those seven architectural types, you know, that are, so there's an attunement of the whole process to a particular super universe. So taking that commonality and then focalizing it down to seven subcategories, okay, and then, you know, see, notice, you know, they mentioned the threefoldness, that literally in the local universe, you have this threefoldness separated. Okay, and I've mentioned this a number of times. This is just, you know, a mind-boggling statement, what the world this means. So it says, there are three primal and essentially different life plans after the order of the three paradise sources and centers. Like, okay, I'm following you. And in the universe of Nebadon, these three basic forms of life are segregated on three different types of planets. What on earth does that mean? I haven't found any place else that alludes to this. I don't, you know, I think this may be the only place. This is obviously something to do with all the unrevealed stuff in the book.
Non-breeders?
No. No, see, not at all. we're talking. See, we're not.
Crosses all different types.
Right. It crosses all different types. As we're talking, I mean, this is something. I mean, literally different types of planets, not different types of beings. We're talking different types of planets. What on earth is a different type of planet?
Well, it's a planet.
Okay. Yeah, it has that in common. It's a sphere of stuff. But what on earth is a different type of planet?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, yeah, you know, and they just pass right on to the next statement.
Cheese.
Right, is it made out of Swiss cheese? Is it, you know, all right, what on earth does that mean? Yeah, now see, but obviously it's not, you know, we're not talking about that. And we're not talking about all those different planetary types that they describe. Those are all about one type of planet. You know, now, and you got to figure out, now, which type are we? Are we Father, Son, or Spirit type planet? What the heck does that mean? Jupiter is the same type as us, you know. Yeah, the neighboring planet is the same type as us. I mean, Midsoniter worlds are the same type as us. What on earth are these other types? You know, all of whose beings are unrevealed, and apparently a whole way of organizing a material sphere is not revealed.
In a different dimension.
Well, it's not going to be magical like in a different dimension. See, that's, you know, it's not like that. Okay, all right. Just want you to, I mean, don't quickly try to dismiss that. Well, I think it's such and so. Okay, don't think about it anymore. I mean, you do not know what that is. You cannot know what that is. That is some radically bizarre statement. Okay. Right, I mean, that's your first thought. I was like, well, does it have something to do with the other six keys? I mean, I don't know what the heck to make of that statement. It's just so, I mean, it doesn't say three different, you know, sort of orders of, you know, there's three different orders of beings, but they're on, you know, it's this whole thing about, like I was describing with the master architects, remembering that there is this very transcendent, mysterious linkage between things and beings. What they're telling you is there's certain types of beings that cannot exist on our type of planet. You have to make a different type of planet for them to be on. It's like, well, what does that mean? I mean, it's not, you only have the 100 elements and this sort of stuff. I mean, and you only have material gravity. Again, there's no, that's all you have. I mean, there's, when you can derive 100 elements from first principles, it's not like they just tell you that. I mean, that's a given. That's all there is. Okay? I mean, you don't have another set of elements or anything.
Well, there's actually 200 because there's 100 more.
Oh, yeah, there's that. Right.
Planet.
Planet. Right. I mean, all beings are domiciled on material abodes, it says. Not on Marantia abodes, not on spirit abodes. So it's not another dimension like that. See, you know, quote unquote, that, you know, fuzzy speak that humans do or like that. No, I mean, this is something very, very mysterious. And if anyone ever comes up with something, that'll be,
They say we're saline, you know, that our planet is based on saline. Well, there's, maybe
it
could just be based on a different life.
Well, no, again, I told you, I mean, you can go and read, you know, that they tell you there's all kinds of different worlds of your type that, you know, have those kinds of variations, you know, of different flavors of electrochemical mechanisms. See, so it doesn't seem like it's that. You know, like I was saying, that they give you all these vast spectrums, basically, that span everything that you, every knob you could think of turning.
What you're saying is there's something out there we don't know anything.
There's a whole bunch of stuff that we know nothing about. You know, even with the fifth epical revelation.
Which is great.
Right.
Couldn't imagine that it could exist.
Right. Yeah. Now that is an intriguing thought. See, to bring in that, it's like, well, all eukaryotic life is predicated on, on prokaryotic life. I mean, every one of my eukaryotic cells has to have mitochondria, prokaryotes, you know, for power plants. You know, every plant eukaryotic cell has to have chloroplasts, you know, prokaryotic power plants. We know that the master physical controllers, you know, the primary associators, don't just make prokaryotes that are kind of related to our type of life. There's also a bunch of other ones that are involved in terraforming the planet in ways that are not so obviously immediately related. They seem to be much more related to the things than the beings. You know, they're not directly involved like cyanobacteria and oxygen production or those sorts of things. You know, they seem less immediately related to the beings and more to the things. Well, is that a clue? I mean, on these other types, I mean, do these other types of prokaryotes that the master physical controllers build, does that give you some hint about, you know, these other worlds and this maybe a radically other type of life or something? I don't know. See, it's a thought, it's something. I mean, that's what you're looking for, something that's, you know, that's totally, okay, go back down to the ground floor and go through the back door somehow and come up in this totally different mode of expression. You know, don't look for the answer somewhere in the column of expression that you're in. This has got to be something very different. And yet, under one common 12-fold and one fold of the 7-fold. Right?
Why don't they specify in the universe of Nebadon?
Well, just because I was trying to say, I mean, in other words, see, like I said, the threefold, you know, your first thought is maybe, you know, you have one, two, three, you know, and then below that you have, you know, under each one of those three you have seven, and then under each seven you have 12. No, it's the other way around. You have 12, and then under the 12 you have seven, and then within each you have, you know, within each local universe of a super universe, see, the next notch down, then you express the three below that fold of the seven. That's what they're trying to get at. That it's in, you know, a reverse hierarchy, you might expect.
Okay. They follow it up with the next sentence about then there were originally 12. Is that
okay? Well, that's yeah.
The three, or is that something different?
No, that's what I was, you know, I was mentioning. You know, you start out with this very definitive common 12, but they see you're combining in a particular seven in one of the seven, and then these different types of the three, and so you have super additive consequences. They're telling you that, you know, the seven gets evolved and modified. You know, it starts 12. I mean, the 12 gets evolved and modified. I said seven, didn't I? The 12 gets evolved and modified because it's coming down, and there's super additive consequences. That's what they're getting at. You know? See, again, it's just reminding you that the 12 is on the top, the originally, okay. But like they said, there's all of the multiples and combinations of these basic numbers. See, as it comes down, there's modifications. Okay, so yeah. You know, even though we don't know what the heck that means specifically, that's the basic pattern. Okay.
Which one do you think we would be of the three primal?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I haven't.
Prime,
I got to try to figure that out sometime. I don't know.
What ocean do you swim in?
I'm not sure yet. I haven't spent a lot of time trying to reflect on that, but I'll see if I can do that. You know, see if I can. I don't know. I don't know yet.
Well, there's an interesting aspect to this, and bringing up the idea of in the universe of Nebadon. These three basic forms of life are segregated on three different types of planets. That begs the question, in other local universes, are these three forms of types not segregated on different types of planets? Are they possibly... Are they possibly together?
Are we reading too much into it?
No, we're not reading too much into it, but I mean, but he's just pointing out, see, there's, you know, every time they tell you something, you know, you got 50 questions, you know, that you can't answer. You know, it's a lot like, what was the other thing that we brought up like that, where we did, you know, we had something else tonight where we couldn't, I mean, there's always all of this, like, well, what about that other local universe? And, you know, there's a number of things they tell you that, remember, we pointed that out a few papers back, where they're saying, well, okay, there's a lot of variation here, but we'll kind of give you the basics that's immediately related to you. But if, you know, if we were to give you an explanation that encompassed every local universe, you know, this would be very huge, and you'd have all, you know, so, yeah, I mean, Andre is totally correct there. I mean, you can't assume that they're not together on one world and some other local universe.
There's five different kinds of planets, or 10 different kinds of planets. Well, no,
that, you know, again, there's three. Mm-hmm. See, that's the thing. You know, there's some definitive things. I mean, it's three because there's three absolute persons. And in another local universe, there aren't five absolute persons. No. See, so you know why it's three, and three is transcendent of any local universe variation. So it's always three, but what the specificity that, you know, the Creator Son has the he has options in all these things. How does he apply that threefoldness?
Yeah.
Right.
Imagine how many there are in the moment.
Right. You're going to have, I would think that, you know, Andre's thought is pretty likely. I would think that there's most likely, I mean, you know, if you can imagine it as a possibility, it's probably necessary to complete the Supreme. So there probably are local universes where.
This might be stupid, but why couldn't there be seven? If there were seven combinations of the Trinity, why couldn't there be seven?
Because you took care of the seven. See, they're trying. You took care of the seven, the notch above. The three, that you know, you have in a particular super universe, you have only one flavor of the seven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jesus lived his life for all planets of his universe.
Yeah, that adds a whole new thing, you know. So what did he do for these other worlds? Yeah.
Feet, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean.
And there's also the possibility that in another local universe, a Creator Son could segregate these three in, you know, by system and decide that a whole system goes that way. That seems radical. But.
Well, and again, see, all of this is going to have some definitiveness. You know, it can't be, he doesn't have, you know, just random variability potential here. I mean, you know, like with systems, I mean, you know, our local system is tied to a specific Havona world. Okay, so, you know, but, see, in the context of a billion different Havona worlds, each of which is absolutely, you know, uniquely different from every other one, that's a lot of different combinations. There's going to be some local systems that are going to be, you know, very, very, very different. You know, if you take something that's that unique, that high, you know, even when you downstep it, all the way down here, there's still going to be a lot of separation. It's not going to blur away. So, yeah, it's just another way that you can imagine, speculate on how different one system can be from another, one constellation from another, one local universe from another. You know, how some local universes may have a whole bunch of suns that another local universe doesn't even have, and on you go. Mm-hmm. Right? Right, yeah.
Number 10 decimal systems inherent in the physical universe, but not in the spiritual. So, like, for when it's down here configured as 12, it would actually be 10, and then two more would be the spiritual, and it goes on like.
No, not like that, not like that. The 10 is a totally separate. So, you have 3, 7, 10, and 12. You have all four numbers, you know, combining and interacting. Okay. No matter, like I was saying, no matter what 3, 7, or 12, you know, fold you're dealing with, all of those have 10 times 10, 100 elements. The 10 is there throughout it all. Okay, because that's a totally separate. It's an independent number. Okay, the 7 and the 10. I mean. The 7 is not part of the 10. Okay? The 10 is separate from the 7.
Okay. That's physical universe. And the other is it's
right, it's the individuality pattern. So you have tenfold individuality, but you have sevenfold unity. Okay? That's what they mean by that. So in this room, you're manifesting sevenfold, you know, unity and tenfold individuality. Both are in play. Okay, that's just, you know, that's the level of complexity that, you know, that's in the universe. You know, I mean, the fundamental sevenfold gets expressed as seven super universes, but we know within each super universe you actually have all seven. It's just that one of the seven is dominant. That's what you mean by, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is you actually have seven in all seven. But one of the seven is dominant in each. You know, the ascension scheme is dominant in this one, and the other six are recessive. Well, we have all seven, because, you know, that's why we have seven reflective spirits.
But I was thinking, like, it says has the 48 units of pattern control, I mean, there's 46 chromosomes.
Okay.
So the two, wait a minute.
Okay.
So the two added to the, to make it 48 would be the spiritual.
No, no. Let me explain
why
how that
don't
works.
You want, because
it's not right, because you can figure it out. Okay. Again, you got the tricky thing about this is when you have numbers, as Andre knows really well, because he started his life out in this mode, you don't want to go into numerology. Because if you just go numerologically, you can rationalize anything. There's no constraints. You can pick the numbers and play them however you want. If you want the number to say such and so, you can make it do that. See, so the key is to let go of you wanting it to be anything, like you wanting it to be two spiritual things, okay? And just figuring out what the pattern demands that you accept. What is it objectively? Okay, let's get to that. Okay, so the everyone knows that the last part here is has caused all kinds of consternation, and if you'll allow me, I'm basically going to avoid that. But okay, let's look at it. So they're pointing out that it comes down to the bottom line here. We have the 12-fold in play, and multiples. Okay. And they have, like Andre read, 12, 24, 48, etc. And out of that list, it says we're the 48. Okay, so what are they talking about? Okay, are they talking about, you know, any old thing you could rationalize? No, you got to figure out specifically what they're talking about. And they're very precise so that you don't have any wiggle room if you look closely. Okay, 48 units of pattern control. Okay, once you know how a cell works, there's no wiggle room. Okay, before people knew how a cell worked and they were interpreting this, there was wiggle room. Okay, but there's no wiggle room anymore. Okay, we now know how a cell works. We know the difference between pattern and pattern control in the way a cell works. Okay, if you don't distinguish, you're going to misinterpret this. You have to distinguish. What's the difference between pattern and pattern control? Okay, it's all, you know, boils down. We know that we have chromosomes in the nucleus of our cell. Okay, and how does that process work? A chromosome is a strand of DNA, which is a double, you know, the double helix that everyone knows. You have two strands linked together, you know, and spiraling in a helix. Okay. What's it there for? Well, you take a particular length of one of those strands, and a copy is made of a single strand molecule, RNA. Okay, it doesn't copy the whole length, but a segment of one of the strands is copied. Okay, and then that RNA goes out and is laid down as a pattern, and you make proteins off of that pattern. Okay, and it's a lot like the tissue paper pattern for making a garment. It's not very robust. You can only use that pattern for a little while, and then it falls apart, just like the tissue paper pattern with clothes. You can only use it for so long, and it falls apart, and you got to make a new tissue pattern. Okay, you make that tissue pattern off of a pattern control. Okay, why is the DNA controlled, like in clothing, where you have a marker, where you have a heavy cardstock, that doesn't degrade like the tissue paper, but it's not very convenient for working with on a piece of bendy fabric. Okay, you need something that's bendy like fabric, so that's why you use the tissue. Okay, but you have this, you can always go back, and the pattern control is still integrous, and you can cut out exactly the right shape of tissue pattern. Okay, Well, everyone should learn this because it's a very easy way to understand this, okay? But, yeah, I know. But, okay, so because it's a double strand and they're linked together, you know, if there's any damage to one of the strands, they're a complementary pair. If you damage one side, the other side tells you how to fix it, how to put it back. Those strands are controlled, okay? They're integrous. They're not like the tissue paper pattern. They're pattern controls, okay? You have 48 units of pattern control. You have 48 strands, okay? See, now they're units of pattern control or units of trait determiners, okay? What are trait determiners? Genes, okay? You have 48 units of genes, 48 strands of genes. You know, and it's very important that you take a particular chromosome, you know, particular DNA strand. I mean, the proteins that you make, you know, off of one strand is not what you make off the other strand. They're independent. Just because they're complementary and can fix each other, they're still, you know, you need both strands to make all the, you know, have all the genes that you need to work. Okay? You're designed with 48 of those strands of trait determiners, packaged together in pairs, 24 different chromosomes, 22 autosomes, 2 sex chromosomes, you know, an X and a Y. Okay, those 24 chromosomes to give you the 48 units of pattern control. Okay, yeah, so that you can make 48 different patterns, because you have 48 units of pattern control. Okay, so that's, you know, and if you assume a similar implementation, you don't, you know, I mean, it could be implemented in a lot of ways, but let's assume maybe at least that it's implemented similarly. What if it was 12 and not 48? Okay, so then you would have, you know, you have 12 units of pattern control, you know, and they come in pairs, so you'd have 6 different chromosomes in that will creature. Okay, and if it's similarly implemented, you'd have 4 autosomes and 2 sex chromosomes. 6 total chromosomes, 12 units of pattern control. So that's the design level that we're talking about here. We're just talking about designing life, not implementing it. I brought in a little bit of implementation, but you know, assuming, you know, that when it's implemented, there's just 2 sex chromosomes, for instance. You know, I'm sure there's all kinds of variations, but you know, forgetting about the difference between the autosomes and the sex chromosomes, you know, you just have 24 different chromosomes, 48 units of pattern control. And then you could start to imagine different ways of implementing them. Now, if you go to the implementation level, okay, now the first thing that they did, when they wanted to get you to think first about the sex cells. You notice they didn't say somatic cells. They said sex cells, the germ cells, okay? To try to help you with this issue of how to properly interpret it. You know, what do you have in a sperm cell or an egg cell, you know, a sex cell? You have 22 autosomes and one of the sex chromosomes, you know, so it's 22 autosomes in an X or 22 autosomes in a Y.
That's 23.
And there's 23 in there. And, you know, you put you put two of those together and get a somatic cell. Okay, and you have 46, okay? But you don't have 46 different, you have 2 of each of the autosomes, 22 autosomes, you know, and maybe you have 2 X's, or an X and a Y, okay? But see, again, that's just, you know, how it's being implemented. It could, there's probably a zillion different ways this is implemented, and the stuff, the different, you know, the connection between sex cells and somatic cells and all this sort of stuff. I mean, we can't even figure out, there's different worlds and everything, for Pete's sake. I mean, you know, yeah, forget about all the implementation stuff. Just back up You know, and you know, if someone says, you know, how many chromosomes do humans have? And they give you a, hand you a chart. Does it have, you know, how many chromosomes does that have? It has 24 on it. They show you the 24 different chromosomes, okay? Because we have 24 different ones, two in each. We have 48 units of pattern control. Don't get lost in the weeds of the implementation. You know, especially, you know, you can imagine why they would say sex cells specifically to try to nudge you away, because back in these days, we were confused. We thought there were 48 chromosomes in a somatic cell. Now, and that would immediately lead to a false association in your mind. They're trying to direct you away. Back then, we thought there was 24 in a sex cell. So there's no way you're going to, well, 24 equals 48. Right? But a lot of readers have done that for years. It's like, no, they're trying to help you to not do that. Now, you know, now you can't do it at all because, you know, we know it's 23 and 46. And so, you know, again, just think about, okay, they're not talking about implementation here. They're talking about design. You're designed with 48 units of pattern control. They're not talking about how you're implemented. Okay? It's a design paper. So just, you know, and it's all there in just pattern control, not pattern. You know, not chromosome. I mean, they didn't use the word chromosome. If they meant you to interpret it as chromosome, they would have said chromosome. It's like, well, they didn't know that word. Yes, they did. Look, do a search on the book. The word chromosome is in the book, okay? If they meant chromosome, they would have said it, okay? But you know they don't, because sex cells don't have anything like 48 chromosomes in it, then or now, ignorant or not, right? So, it's just, it's all there just to recognize if you just are very precise about it.
So these creatures that have 768.
Yeah, wow. Okay, you know, we're running past here. We're running a little late here, but let's make a quick thing on that. You know, remember, you know, if you know anything about genetics, it's not like the pinnacle of evolution that's, you know, waving his arm on the couch here, us humans, we've got more chromosomes than anyone. No, I mean, guinea pigs have more than we do. Okay?
That's
I mean, some things have lots and lots of chromosomes in a somatic cell, you know, and it's like, well, maybe they have lots of copies of one. Yeah, that's true sometimes, but I mean, sometimes where they just have, like us, you know, two of each autosome, they've got a lot more autosomes than we do, okay? You know, there's a big difference between how many chromosomes you have and how advanced the life is. Those are not in any way linearly correlated or anything, okay? So just that lesson feeds into this. You know, you shouldn't go, oh, well, ones with 768 are like really like super beings, you know, or something. No, I mean, it must have something, you know, doesn't make them better than us or something, you know, and 12ers are less than us. You know, you shouldn't assume that. I mean, just what we know about it, the difference between guinea pigs and humans and how many chromosomes we have speaks against that, okay? So, you know, if you're going to try to rationalize that, you should probably, you know, Andre talked about this, you should probably go to, you know, all of those descriptions of all the different types of worlds of our flavor, you know, and it's like, well, maybe, you know, if you're going to have one of those extreme electric worlds or whatever, you know, I mean, who knows? But, I mean, what's the difference between two-brainers, and, you know, one-brainers, two-brainers, and three-brainers in this regard? How do I know? You know, there's all kinds of things that could feed into this.
Ask a three-brainer.
You know, there could even be simple issues of redundancy necessary in a harsh environment or something, or, you know, I don't know. But anyway, so we'll wrap it up there, and we'll get onto the other worlds next time. But, yeah, pretty fun paragraph there with bringing up all those details. All right, let's just take a moment here and reflect on the complexity that is the universe.